What's good, Wordsmiths? For first-time listeners, welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock. And for those who tuned in before, welcome back. I know I'm super late, but Happy New Year. I know that sounds crazy to say because it's damn near March, but it's been a few months since I spoke to y'all. I haven't released an episode since the start of the new year, so I just want to wish everyone a prosperous 2024 with the least amount of stress possible. I promise that in 2024, my output will be more consistent than in 2023. And y'all can hold me accountable to that as well. I've been living life and trying to get back in shape post Achilles surgery. Like I told y'all about, I cut my hair. I had to, you know, cut all that energy off. So I'm back rocking my signature fade. But, you know, I'm back and excited for what's in store for this year. Today's guest is none other than the notorious PhD, Dr. Todd Boyd. Outside of his informative cultural commentary on basically every documentary ever made, Dr. Boyd has been a tenured professor in the University of Southern California's Cinematic Arts Department for over 30 years. He's written various articles and essays, co-wrote and produced 1999's cult classic, The Wood, and is the author of 8 books, including his most recent offering, Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World. In part one of this 2-part interview, Dr. Boyd revealed that his inspiration for wanting to earn his PhD didn't come from other PhDs, but ironically from being a fan of how sportscasters spoke with respect about Basketball Hall of Famer Julius Dr. J. Irving during a time when black men were commonly demeaned in the media. Dr. Boyd couldn't play like Dr. J, but that led to him eventually earning that respect years down the line after earning a PhD. Dr. Boyd spoke about how he's subconsciously been writing this book since he was 9 years old and how his lifelong love of sports, film, television, politics, music, magazine, and overall culture laid the foundation of everything he's done in his professional career. Later in college, Dr. Boyd realized that he could make a living intellectualizing all the media he's consumed. He later spoke about how rhyming has always been a part of black culture even before hip-hop, being a pioneer in collegiate hip-hop education, the performative nature of his teaching style, how hip-hop made the world, people critiquing materialism in hip-hop, and people falling victim to their own nostalgia. I know everyone will enjoy Dr. Boyd's candor, humor, and knowledge as I did, but, you know, it doesn't stop there. Look out for part 2 next week. Yes, I know y'all wasn't expecting that, but, you know, Dr. Boyd, he's a talkative guy. So, and I had so much to ask him. I had so much to add to the interview, to the conversation. So, yeah, look out for that part 2 next week, and please like, comment, and subscribe. Words matter. Welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock, a podcast dedicated to wordsmiths and storytellers. You know, I feel like everyone who's watching this interview, even if they don't know this man's name, they'll recognize him because he's, you know, been in damn near every documentary ever made. But, you know, according to Wikipedia, I know Wikipedia is not always the most reliable source, but he's been in 68 documentaries.
That's low.
That's low. I knew it was low. Ballpark,
but that's low.
Yeah. Giving his expert critique and analysis on sports, hip hop, pop culture, and various black experiences in America. You might know him from his documentary, his commentary in the Emmy Award winning The Last Dance, 20 Feet from Stardom. We Need to Talk About Cosby and Vic, just to name a few. He co-wrote and produced 1999's coming-of-age film, The Wood, starring Omar Epps, Richard T. Jones, and Taye Diggs. He's been a professor at the University of Southern California's Division of Cinema and Media Studies for 32 years and counting, and he's currently the Catherine and Frank Price Chair for Study of Race and Pop Culture. His research areas include African-American cinema, New Hollywood, hip-hop culture, cultural politics, and sports media. He's written over 100 articles, essays, reviews, as well as 9 books, including 2008's African Americans and Popular Culture, volumes 1-3. And most recently, and the reason why we're here today, is to speak about Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World, published by Phaidon. Without further ado, Words Matter Pod would like to give a warm welcome to the notorious PhD, Dr. Todd Boyd.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for sitting down with me, man. I appreciate that, you know. And I was telling Ryan off camera, you know, I'm trying to compete with you a little because, you know, you be putting that shit on, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm looking in my closet doing a lot of self-reflection, trying to figure out like how I'm gonna approach this. But how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Very good. Thank you.
So, who are you?
Wow. Who am I? I guess that depends. You know, I can be many different characters, depending on the film, depending on the play, depending on the circumstances. Yeah. Hard to answer that one.
Yeah, I get it. Not a question that people ask you often.
Well, when you say, who am I, like, that's, you know, multiple levels. You know, that's internal and external.
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain in the time we have. You know, that's another book.
So, what was happening in Dr. Boyd's life prior to earning your PhD?
You know, I'm from Detroit, and you know, I was in Detroit in the 80s, which was a really interesting time. Interesting, I guess, is one way to put it. You know, I mean, I was a dude who was young and in college and then just out of college and trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was interested in being a sportscaster, actually. I was previously interested in being a basketball coach, college basketball coach, and then a sportscaster. I was really into sports.
Yeah.
And so my focus was on doing something in that area. And I had a few opportunities and some good experiences, some bad experiences, but I was also a young dude, you know, in Detroit when, you know, things were intense.
Yeah.
You know, this is the beginning of the crack cocaine era, and a lot of people I know are getting popped and going to jail, and others are getting addicted, and it's, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I had to figure out what I was going to do, and I wanted a PhD. When I was a kid in the 70s, you know, I was really impressed with Dr. J, Julius Erving.
He didn't have a PhD, though.
No, he didn't have a PhD. He wasn't a medical doctor either, but the way that sportscasters talked about him was with respect. When they said Dr. J, they put respect on his name.
And mm-hmm.
Even though he wasn't a PhD or a medical doctor, MD, I wanted that kind of respect when people, you know, spoke my name. And because I couldn't hoop like Julius Erving, I decided to go to graduate school to try and accomplish that. So I'm in Detroit and, you know, got an opportunity to go to graduate school at the University of Iowa. And Detroit was crazy at that moment. And the block was hot, as they say. And
yeah.
So, you know, I went to grad school and did my thing.
Mm-hmm. What media were you consuming, you know, growing up during that time?
I mean, I was always into, you know, music for sure. From, you know, old school R&B, soul music, early hip hop. But I was also into movies.
Yeah.
Watched a lot of film, you know. I mentioned sports. You know, the culture, really. I mean, you know, I've always been interested in multiple things, politics. When I was a kid, again, you know, my father was really into music, and he's really, really into movies. And a lot of times when I was with my dad, you know, he would go see movies, and this is a great era in the 70s, so, you know, I'm watching Godfather Part II and The Exorcist and watching Superfly, you know. French Connection.
Mm.
You know, I saw all those classics with my dad because he was really into it, James Bond movies.
Yeah.
And so I was always interested in, like, just culture, especially music, you know, increasingly film, magazines, newspapers. I was really into photos. A lot of this is in the book. You know, I've been telling people as I've been making the media rounds, promoting the book, I started writing the book really when I was 9 years old. I was writing it before I knew I was writing it, you know. And it's because I was absorbing all this culture. I mean, I don't know if people appreciate this so much now, but at the time, magazine photographs were huge. You know, magazines were big. And they had these great photographers, you know. And I remember all that. And album covers, movie posters, you know. You go watch a movie back then, and you'd get this whole display at the theater, lobby cards, and, you know, coming attractions. And I just absorbed all that. So I was consuming a lot of media, a lot of culture, a lot of music, film, just, you know, overall culture. And that, you know, became really the basis for everything I ended up doing professionally.
Yeah. I mean, you know, funny enough, you said that Dr. J kind of inspired you to get a PhD. But, I mean,
that's crazy, but yeah. I didn't know any real PhDs, you know. I mean, I knew that if you were a PhD, people might call you doctor, but I knew who Dr. J was.
Yeah.
And that just kind of speaks to, you know, how I was growing up. If I had known real PhDs, it might have been different, but I didn't. So that was the doctor I knew.
Like, damn, I'm going to be a doctor, but I can't play basketball?
Right,
like,
right. Nah, I could be a real doctor.
Yeah.
You know, they call him Dr. J. You know, much love. I can be the real thing. But that was the inspiration, though.
Yeah. I mean, so, but when you say that, right, was that like a dream you expressed to your parents? And, you know, would they ask, like, you know, what do you want to get a PhD in?
I didn't express it to my parents because my parents were old school.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had to be real concrete, whatever you expressed to them. You know, I think I just liked the fact that when people talked about Dr. J, they put respect on his name. And in the 70s, you didn't see a lot of black men on television who people spoke about in respectful tones.
Yeah.
So there was something different about the way people talked about Dr. J than everybody else. And I didn't fully understand all this at the time, of course, but over time I realized what that was. There was respect. That when they talked about him, it wasn't, you know, hostile or aggressive.
Or demeaning.
Or demeaning. Yeah. Or it wasn't as though they were, you know, dismissing him. They were respecting him. As I say, I love basketball, but I knew, you know, I wasn't Dr. J, even though I spent hours in the gym trying to perfect that shot he made on the Lakers where he goes behind the basket. I never could get it right. I never could get it, but I tried. But I guess my point is, you know, whatever your environment may be, there may be things in that environment that are inspirational. And a lot of people might come along and say, you know, why are you spending all this time watching sports if you're not playing basketball? Not that I didn't want to. But I'm just saying that spark later manifests itself in me getting a PhD. I don't know that I actually started focusing on that, until, you know, a lot later, in the 80s when I'm older. And I took a class in college and the professor said, we're going to watch movies like The Godfather, and he mentioned Scarface, TV shows like Miami Vice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there like, I'm already watching all that and talking about it with my friends and my father. I didn't realize people, you know, could be professors in universities focusing on something like that. And I'm like, really? Like, you do that? So I'm like, at that point, I was, oh, wow. Well, I'm already doing this. And now I can do it at an intellectual level. I mean, I was hooked. So, you know, that happened right before I went to grad school. But what I'm saying is the seed was planted with Dr. J a decade earlier.
Unconsciously. You know, at this point, you know, we could, you know, fast forward into hip hop a little bit. But, you know, at this point, it's universally accepted that hip hop's birthday is August 9th, 1973. But rap as an art form wasn't on wax until Rapper's Delight, you know, first commercially successful rap single 6 years later. Back then, information wasn't spread as fast. And, you know, coming from Detroit, which is halfway across the country from the birthplace of the culture, you know, between 1973 and 1979, did any aspect of hip hop culture touch Detroit on an underground level? like how it did in New York?
I mean, I think the thing about hip-hop in the 70s, and this I talk about in the book in the first chapter, like you had to be there to experience it because, you know, it wasn't available in any kind of tangible form. It was an experience. You know, I remember my guy Chuck D talking about how amazed he was when they finally made a record because he had been able to experience that and, you know, thinking about how you would get that experience on a record. So, you know, for much of the 70s, hip-hop is underground and it's specific to New York, but hip-hop didn't just, you know, spring forward out of the ground. Like, there's things that lead into what becomes hip-hop. There's a history before hip-hop.
Yeah.
And these are some of the things I talk about in the first chapter of the book also, inspirations and, you know, iconic figures. But all those elements, you know, of what's happening in 70s America, urban America, you know, are things that happen across the country, not just in New York. So the music was taking place in New York, but the conditions were prevalent in a lot of other places. So by the time you could hear the music outside of, like, the Bronx and Queens, what have you, the rest of the cultural apparatus had already, like, you know, created the space for that to emerge.
And it's like the music is emerging, and it's like, I'm already familiar with these kinds of people, you know, not these people specifically, but these kinds of people, these kinds of conditions that are spoken about in, you know, songs like The Message and stuff already. So it's like you know the music before you even know the music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of music and particularly, let's say, rhyming, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the culture. So, you know, I mean, I heard Muhammad Ali, you know, rhyme before he whooped somebody's ass. like, you know, I got a rhyme for you, you know, and then I'm going to whoop your ass. Like, that appealed to me. you know, Nipsey Russell, somebody I mentioned in the book also, comedian, used to be on all these game shows in the 70s, and whenever they would introduce Nipsey Russell, he would say a rhyme. And of course, Nipsey Russell is the namesake of the cat Nipsey who later Hussle. Becomes Nipsey Hussle, right? You know, like, you could pass people in the street, and, you know, I mean, I'm from Detroit, like, you know, you might see a pimp in the street rhyming. you might overhear him, you know, rhyming, like, talking about his game. So it's part of the oral tradition. I mean, preachers, like, you mm-hmm. know. So you had all these things before anybody called it hip-hop, and then hip-hop took all that oral tradition and put it into a, you know, context where later you could hear it on record.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm saying is the language was familiar, even if the form itself was not immediately familiar, yeah. It became familiar because the elements were already there.
Yeah. You know, when you were in your teens and 20s in the 80s and adults would say that hip-hop was a fad and, you know, it wasn't a real genre of music, how were you responding to that back then?
I mean, honestly, I wasn't really paying much attention to, you know, as people back then would say, non-believers.
Yeah.
I liked the music, and I really wasn't so concerned that other people didn't like it because I assumed they just weren't hip. They didn't get it. And there was a lot of animosity from people of an older generation towards mm-hmm. hip-hop. You know, they dismissed it. I mean, there's nobody singing. People were used to singers.
Yeah.
And there were some great singers, of course, in the 70s. You know, people were used to that. You know, so if you're used to Aretha Franklin and Curtis Mayfield, and now you hear somebody rapping, like, that might take you a minute before you can appreciate what they're saying. So there were a lot of haters and naysayers, but I wasn't really paying much attention because I liked the music and it spoke to me. You know, when I went to college, my freshman year in college, Michael Jackson's Thriller came out and also Prince 1999. And everybody I knew was listening to one or both. And I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be different. I'm from an era when if everybody else went right, I just have to go left on principle. And so everybody's listening to Michael and Prince, and I'm like, I want to hear Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I want to hear Bambaataa, you know what I'm saying? I want to hear DMC. And so that was always my lane. And I think, honestly, I appreciated the fact that a lot of people didn't get it, because that made me feel stronger and more firm in my conviction, because I felt like, you know, you don't get it because you're not hip. This is not for everybody. That would change.
Yeah.
But in that moment, it's like, you don't get it because it's over your head.
Mm-hmm. And, then, you know, as a kid, I mean, that gives you a certain kind of validation. It's like, man, I've been doing this. I don't know what, you know what y'all doing.
Y'all late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Did you ever want to rap?
I used to be an MC, man, when I was in college. But see, I'm so old, you know, I'm an OG. When I was doing my thing, MC's jobs were to hype the crowd. And it changed by the late 80s, you know, when Rakim came along, and it's like bars.
You know?
Sort of poetic piece was added to lyricism. Like, you got to be a poet with it.
Mm-hmm.
My era, it was about hyping the crowd. So I talk about this in the book also. I mean, I was, for a minute, you know, I was doing my thing on the mic. And, you know, I'm a, you know, talkative oral cat anyway, always have been. So you put a mic in my hand, I was right at home.
Yeah.
The difference is, a few years later, you know, they raised the stakes. And I never stepped up to that level. This is about the time I'm getting ready to go to grad school. So I never learned to do it like Rakim was doing it.
Yeah.
But from that era before, I was doing my thing. So I came out of the culture. It's just that the era that I came out of, things were a little different than it would be by the time you got to the late 80s. And also, you know, when I was coming up, I didn't know anybody who thought about hip-hop as a job.
Yeah.
Like, this is something you can do to, like, eat. Like, you can make a living doing it. I didn't know anybody who thought like that.
Everybody just looked at it like it was a hobby.
Yeah, you dig the music or whatever. But, you know, a few years, I guess what I'm getting at is, a few years later, in a short period of time, things changed. And then it's like, you know, oh, you can be a rapper. When I was in college, I don't know that people necessarily thought about what it meant to be a rapper. Mm-hmm. That was your identity. That was your, you know, employment. That was your gig.
Yeah.
So I'm a little before that, and it changed. And by the time it changed, I was, you know, working on a PhD, so I was on a different tip by that point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, nowadays so many people rap and are in college, and you got rappers. You know, J. Cole got a degree, and he was a rapper. So,
I mean, but you know, if you listen to, you know, I'm DMC and the place to be.
I went to St. John's University. Yeah.
And since kindergarten, I acquired the knowledge. And after 12th grade, I went straight to college. I mean, that's, you know, early hip hop. And then people stopped talking about college until Kanye came along. you know, college dropout. But, you know, I mean, that was a common rhyme, you know. And I'll never forget that, because after that, people stopped talking about that.
It's true. I mean, well, you know, times change where a lot of the kids that would be in college was hustling.
Yeah. Definitely.
I mean, in Detroit, you know, more just what's going on in Detroit at the time. What was the music scene like? What was the hip hop scene like?
I mean, you know, people listening to hip hop, and you had like a what I call a burgeoning scene. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think most of that took off after I left to go to grad school, because, as I'm saying, so much happened in a short period of time. So I started graduate school in 1988, and by the time I was finished in 1991, it was a whole different world in terms of hip-hop. You know, but there was always hip-hop heads and spots to go, and, you know, Detroit was also, at the time, you know, real big into house music.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, you know, really dealing with no house music.
You wasn't dancing?
Nah, that ain't my bag. but, you know, me and my friend, we would go to those spots because, you know, like, the spots that play their house music, would always have a large number of women, and a lot of those spots didn't serve alcohol, so they could stay open later.
Yeah.
And we would go and, you know, parking lot. We'd post parking up in the parking lot, you know, wait for the let out, and you know what I'm saying? So, but we never liked the music.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, this is the place to go because, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But in terms of hip-hop, I mean, I think there were things happening, but, like, by the time I left and then, you know, I remember this cat, Awesome Dre and the Hardcore Committee. That's for some old Detroit hip-hop heads. And dude had a video live at the Latin Quarter. And I'm like, whoa, like, I was in graduate school when I saw this video. And I'm like, you know, this is some local, you know, music. And now it's a video for it that you could watch on Yo MTV Raps was crazy to me. So a lot changed in a short period of time.
Man. Yeah, there's always a debate, I guess, with people whether a house started in Detroit or Chicago. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I'm not a house
historian.
Music historian. So I don't want to speak out of turn, but you know, I'm gonna rep Detroit just because that's where I'm from. Much love to Chicago. I like, you know, giving people in Chicago a hard time. But I've been in L.A. so long, and when you get to L.A., Detroit, and Chicago, we're like cousins.
Yeah.
But when you're in Detroit or Chicago, particularly at this time, because this is when the Bad Boys, the Pistons, were playing the Bulls and Jordan, so it was real heated.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm going to always vote for Detroit. But I've heard those debates, and I know people who are very invested in them. I can't speak because I never really got that deep into that music, but I know of those debates.
Yeah, no, I get it. I feel you. You know, hip hop classes are taught in institutions of higher education. And, you know, you talk about how in the '80s, you realized that you could make a living as a hip hop intellect, right? You know, Lupe Fiasco teaches at MIT, Ninth Wonder is a professor at Duke, D1, the Christian rapper, teaches at Tufts University. As a fan of hip hop, did you think 40 years ago that, you know, this very niche cultural phenomenon would be something that people, including yourself, would, you know, someone with a PhD would bring to academia?
I mean, I got to USC in 1992, you know, right after, literally in the shadow of the Rodney King riots. And so I taught my first class here at USC in the fall of 1992, and I was dealing with hip-hop from jump.
Yeah.
That was 1992. So, you know.
Year before I was born.
A lot of people, you know, talking to me now about hip-hop being taught in universities. And I'm like, where was you in 92?
Mm.
And I'm here in L.A., you know, like I said, right after the riots. And this is the same year the Chronic came out. You know, I was telling the story, which is in the book as well. Bill Clinton went on the Arsenio Hall show and played the saxophone, and that same week he attacked a rapper named Sister Soulja and compared her lyrics to the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
So this is all going on, and, you know, I remember first class I'm teaching, and a lot of people at the time, professors as well as students, you know, they weren't accustomed to hearing somebody talk about hip-hop in a college classroom.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to do, I knew, you know, when I got here, USC was going to be a huge platform, and it was important for me to be able to incorporate the work I was doing into a space like this. And so, you know, as somebody who came out of the culture and then, you know, went about creating the study of hip-hop in American universities, honestly, I did that a long time ago. So it's great to see people doing it now. It was a lot different back then, a lot less reception to it. People were, like, hostile in a lot of ways. But other people loved it because it gave them something to connect to that they identified with. So, you know, I'm glad to have had that opportunity, and I feel like as I've watched people study hip-hop in the academy grow, you know, I'm happy to have had a hand in creating that, you know, from the jump. I was reading an article by some cat who, like, you know, for his PhD dissertation, made an album. And I started laughing.
The kid with the big afro, I think I know what you're talking about.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure if I ever saw a picture.
Yeah.
And I saw it, and I'm like, okay, he created an album. That was his, like, dissertation. And I laughed to myself because I'm like, there's no way in the world I could have proposed making an album in the late 80s, early 90s as a dissertation. You know, more power to him, but it's just a different day.
Yeah. But, I mean, would you have done that, though, if you had the opportunity back then?
I mean, if I had the opportunity to do something creative like that, it would have certainly been enticing. What I was trying to do was get the knowledge that came with, you know, having a PhD and take all that formality and then create something new out of it. So I was invested in what's the tradition, you know, what's the formal way of doing this? Let me do it. And then take it and create something new. So I was really, like, you know, very much interested in how do you do this? I don't want to do anything special. I want to do it the way you do it. So I learned the fundamentals of the game. And then when I get a job as a professor, I can take my own abilities and creativity and come up with something new. But I was not trying to get away from it.
Yeah.
So honestly, I'm not hating. But it's like, you know, if you want to make a rap record, then you should go sign with a label. If you're trying to get a PhD, then I need you to show me that you can deal with the tradition.
Yeah.
And then perhaps in the future, you know, bring a level of creativity to that. And if you want to make a record, by all means. So I'm older and it's a different generation.
Yeah.
But, you know, I needed to show people that I could do it.
In their world.
In their world.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's like, I call it the fusion of the formal and the vernacular. It's like, take the formal, take the vernacular. Like, let me learn how to do this the right way. And I put right in quote marks. And then once I learn how to do it the right way, I can flip it. This is what jazz musicians like Miles Davis did. Like, they learned how to play the instrument the traditional way, and then they flipped it and brought their own creativity to it. So that's what I was trying to do.
It's like, you know, doing things that you need to do in order to doing, you know, have a life where you can do the things that you want to do.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
I read an LA Times profile on you from 2003 by Bob Baker. I don't know if you remember this, but he briefly wrote about how polarizing you were in the academic world, and some professors at USC didn't even want to speak about you when asked. he described you as...
Professors at other places also.
He described
prominent
you...
Prominent places.
What were you saying?
Prominent places.
Yeah.
I remember when he told me that.
He described you as, quote, knowledgeable, engaging, and independent-minded, end quote. But he also described you as an egomaniac, an iconoclast, and intellectual hedonist, end quote. Which, depending on your career or what kind of person you are, I don't really think those last three things he described you as are necessarily bad things.
What did he say again?
He said you were an egomaniac, an iconoclast, and an intellectual hedonist.
Gotcha. That's an honor.
Yeah, it's like, you know, based on what you do.
Man, Bob Baker passed away, so he was a very nice man, and we spent a lot of time together for that feature. I don't know if Bob fully understood it at the time. I remember the last conversation we had before he wrote the piece, and he had come to my class, you know, for about a month or so. And we had talked on the phone, and we had a few meals. We spent a lot of time together that feature. And I remember the last time we sat down, we met at this restaurant Toscana in Brentwood that I used to go to all the time. One of my good friends introduced me to it.
Yeah, he mentioned that. Yeah.
I think he mentions it. So we're at Toscana, and you know, I went there a lot and people knew me, and agents and other people are coming up to the table and saying hello. And I think he was like, wow, like, you know, seeing you in class is different than, you know, here you are in this plush place in Brentwood and everybody knows who you are. Like, I don't know if he fully understood what he saw me do in class was a performance. You know, I mean, it's like one of the things I've always done is as a way to educate people, you know, I'm going to give you a persona. You're not dealing with me.
Yeah.
Necessarily, this is a character. Notorious PhD, the title actually came out of that article he wrote. That's where the title came from.
Wow.
This is a character. Like, you know, and I would come to class at the time, you know, this is when throwback jerseys were popular. And
he
I
said you were wearing a...
wearing a throwback.
A Orlando Magic jersey.
I think I had on Tracy McGrady that day.
03, so probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was McGrady. You know, so jerseys and... in particular, and then throwback jerseys, like, you know, I mean, I don't know what I might have had on the next time he saw me, but I was repping. It was a look, you know, and I had on Jordans, and, you know, I had a scarf tied on my head, like Pac tied in the front. this was all me playing a character. This is what the Notorious PhD is, because when you deal with the public, you can't give your actual self to the public because people will devour you. They need a character. So what I did was I came up with a character. And I don't know if Bob ever fully understood that. Yeah. So I'm talking shit and I'm, you know, being hyperbolic and all of that's a performance though. That's not who I am.
Yeah.
But it made for a great article and, you know, a lot of people took my classes and that's how I built a name and a reputation, as I say. They called me Notorious PhD. That was the title of the article, and it stuck. But that was a character. So I'm not an egomaniac. I don't think I am.
That's not for you to judge.
Intellectual hedonist. What was the other one? What was the third one?
Iconoclast.
Iconoclast.
I had to look that up.
That might actually apply. But it was all in the interest of being a character. And at the same time, you got to realize – I was teaching two classes, one of which had 350 people. The other had 150 people. So I'm talking to 500 people, right? I'm not talking to four or five people. I'm talking to 500. And when you operate in a space like that, you know, fortunately, I've always had the ability that I could take all of this intellectual material and present it to people in a way that, you know, they can digest it. And it was through that character. But, you know, when you're speaking to that many people, you need something. Because, you know, if you look it up, I think you'll find, like, when they talk about people's biggest fears, a lot of people's biggest fear is the fear of public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking to 500 people a week, right? So, you know, and then more in the media, and if I go, you know, do lectures at places. So this was the character that I developed. Which came to be known as Notorious PhD. And as I say, rest in peace. Bob was a good dude. I don't know if he ever fully understood that.
Yeah, rest in peace to him, man, because it was a great article and visually just, you know, I kind of just had a just great visual of everything, you know, that he was describing at the time. But, I mean, that makes a lot of sense that you were talking about just being a character at the time. You feel like you could be, like, more of yourself now?
Well, I'm an OG,
yeah.
You know, so when you get to be an OG, people tend to react differently towards you. And, you know, it's kind of like hip-hop. Like, you know, hip-hop's 50 years old. So what you're doing when you're 20 or 30 is different than what you're doing when you're 50.
True.
I mean, I think the difference is now, you know, the volume's a little bit lower. And... you know, I used all that to get me to a certain point, and I'm at a different place in my life now. I'm at a different place in my work now. And I think, you know, my book reflects that. But, you know, there was a time, you know, back then when he wrote that article, and that was, you know, 20 years ago, 21 years ago, I was very much interested in provoking people, which is perhaps what he means when he says iconoclast. I mean, If you ask me now, I don't want no smoke. You know, I don't want no smoke.
Especially with the internet, you can't beat the internet.
I mean, it's just I don't have the energy for it.
Yeah.
Like, nor do I have a desire. Like, I've done that, you know. It's like, you know, if you're playing in the NBA, at a certain point, you're out of the league, you know, and sometimes we look at these guys who still try to hang on and they had no identity beyond that. My identity has grown and evolved, and it's Notorious PhD, but
you're still in the league, though.
Well,
you're just working on your mid-range more.
I mean, the way I look at it is that's one take on it. I look at it like, you know, I'm Michael Corleone.
You trying to go legit?
Well, you got to go through several people before you get to Michael Corleone. You can't just walk up to Michael Corleone and start talking. So, you know, it's that level. And when Michael's sitting in Cuba in Godfather 2 at the table and they're passing around the gold telephone, that's where I'm at. That guy right there is different than the young kid who went in the bathroom and
got,
you know,
the gun,
gathered
and
the gun
him.
And came and killed Sollozzo and McCloskey. So I'm in Godfather 2 as opposed to the Godfather right now. That's how I feel.
I get it. No, I get it. I get it for sure. What qualities about you brought you to the point where producers reach out to you as, you know, the one of the go-to people for documentary commentary?
It's funny. My opening event to promote Rappers Deluxe a few weeks back was at the Broad Museum here in L.A. with Chuck D from Public Enemy. And Chuck calls me Mr. Go-To. He's like, "You're Mr. Go-To." Like that, I like that. That's cool. I'm the dude, you know, you go to. End of the game, you need somebody to hit a big shot. I'm the dude you go to.
So you coming off the bench, maybe?
No, I wouldn't say I'm coming off the bench. I'm saying, you know, if you remember Robert Horry, right? Big Shot Bob. Like, when you talk about great basketball players, you know, a lot of times people don't realize how many titles Robert Horry
won. Seven.
Right? And he did it on several different teams, and he was known, you know, for hitting big shots. That's what I do, you know. I mean, I thought about when I came to USC, all this, you know, culture, and I understood what was going on, like music and film and sports and all these areas. And I remember when I saw Do the Right Thing, this is when I was still in grad school, and I'm sitting there in a theater in Chicago watching Do the Right Thing, and I'm like, I'm going to have to be the person to explain this. Like, there's going to be a need for somebody to explain what's going on, and I'm that guy, right? So I wanted to build up a knowledge base and create information in such a ways that, you know, people would need my knowledge. That's the go-to, right? And I wanted to express it in such a way so that when you see me on camera, you know, I didn't grow up in an intellectual family. My parents didn't go to college. I'm the first person in my family to go to college. So when I went to graduate school, I had to explain things to my father, and I had to explain it to him in a language he understood. And I developed the ability to explain all these, like, esoteric academic concepts to him in ways that he would understand. And so I took that, and it's like, well, when you go on camera, first of all, it's a visual medium. So there's a look, like, you know, you got to have the right look. You got to know how to present the information. And most importantly, you have to have the information in order to be able to present it. So, you know, I built up what I consider to be a warehouse of knowledge and assume that at the right time people would reach out to me because I had that knowledge and I had the ability to present it in such a way that it would be considered informative and entertaining.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's, you know, what I've always tried to do is there's the knowledge, right? But I present it in such a way, you know, when you sit down and do
put a little medicine in the candy.
That's the way I've always had to do it because I had to explain it to people in such a way that they understood it, like you meet people where they are. I mean, I know a lot of professors who would say to me, how could you sit there, you know, and do an interview for 2 hours and they cut it down to, you know, a little soundbite. And I'm like, that's the nature of the beast. That's what it is, right? Everybody doesn't have 2 hours to sit up and hear you lecture. And are you good at lecturing? Are you interesting? Or are people going to sleep?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're not going to sleep when I'm talking. And that's because of the way I'm presenting what it is I'm saying. So, you know, I mean, I appreciate people reaching out, and they've been doing it for a long time. Documentaries have gotten to be more popular, and kind of amazing to me, I realized at some point a few years ago, I had no idea people were watching all these documentaries. Yeah. And people started approaching me in the street. And I'm like, all these people are watching documentaries. Wow. Like, you know, it suggested to me that documentaries as a genre had gotten to be really popular and influential, because I didn't realize so many people, you know, were paying attention, but a lot do.
Especially with streaming now, so many streaming platforms, documentaries on every platform.
Exactly.
You probably have a documentary on Peacock, Netflix, Amazon Prime,
everything. Yeah. I'm proud of that too.
Yeah, no, you should.
To be just, you know, one lane.
Yeah. So, you know, the book is titled Rapper's Deluxe, right here, as you can see. That was obviously inspired by the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight, the first top 40 rap song. What's the difference between Rapper's Delight and Rapper's Deluxe?
Well, you know, I kept thinking about Rapper's Delight as the first commercially available, you know, rap song. And that's the point at which, you know, most people outside New York would have heard it for the first time. And I wanted to kind of, you know, play off of that. And I just kept thinking of, like, you know, deluxe. When something is deluxe, it's like extra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like special edition. It's like there's more to it. You know, think about a album that had, like, you know, additional features, you know, instrumentals, bonus cuts, you know.
Hidden tracks.
Hidden tracks.
That's another thing.
Yeah, like, you know, basically the idea being you're getting more than what you're paying for. We're going to give you a little extra. This is deluxe. This is not a regular offering. This is a deluxe offering. You know, you go to a fast food spot, you know, it's like you want to supersize it, right? Like, I was thinking about things like that. Like, what I'm offering you is, like, more than you're paying for. You're getting extra. And Rapper's Deluxe, to me, like, Rapper's Delight, no, Rapper's Deluxe. Like, I wanted the familiarity of, you know, the title, but I also wanted people to think there's a bit more here than what you might expect.
Yeah. You know, the second title of the book is How Hip Hop Made the World. And, you know, I feel like, you know, you explaining or just me bringing up the Bob Baker. Did I say his name right? Yes, the Bob Baker profile and, you know, those adjectives he used to describe you. It kind of makes sense that, you know, you named the book How Hip Hop Made the World. I guess that kind of goes back to him calling you an iconoclast, maybe. Because it's kind of hyperbolic, but I want you to explain, like, what that really means.
So I have to, first of all, you know, shout out Deb Aronson at Phaedon, because, you know, she's the person who initially reached out to me about writing the book. You know, several years ago. And the subtitle, you know, as much as I want to take credit for coming up with it, she actually came up with it.
Oh, wow. Shout out to her.
And props, you know, to Deb, because when she said it, it was perfect. You know, it was just perfect. Like, I couldn't have come up with a better subtitle myself. So, you know, I think it embodies really the point of the book, because the book is about the world in the broadest sense. You know, music and film and sports and politics and language and art, the world.
Yes.
You know, like the cultural world, the social world, the political world. Like, The book is a book about hip hop. It's a book about black culture. It's a book about American culture.
Yes.
It's a book at some level about American culture and its influence across the globe.
It's American history.
It's American history. Right. So, and it's 50 years. We're talking half a century, mm-hmm. you know. So I think the idea that it made the world is a valid point, because when you look at the book, it's not, you know, rap's greatest hits. It's not, you know, the top five rappers of all time. You know, I'm talking about, like, you know, the blackout in New York City in the 1970s, the election of Ronald Reagan.
Sociological events.
That most people would never associate with hip-hop. Deb, who I mentioned, who came up, you know, Fight On, who came up with the subtitle, said to me, of all the books I've ever seen, I've never seen a hip-hop book that included Angela Davis. Mm. I'm like, but that's, you know, that's what's distinct about it. Like, I'm talking about the Black Panthers and Angela Davis. Like, I'm talking about Miles Davis. You know, these aren't necessarily people, Richard Pryor. You don't necessarily think about these names, Ali,
yeah.
think about hip-hop, but they're part of the equation. You know, they're part of the history that hip-hop grew out of, and the history that hip hop influenced. So to me, making the world, like, the book has this kind of global ambition, global in a geographic sense, but also global in a cultural sense. Like, we're beyond where we started. We're so far beyond, you know, where we started. And this you get when you get to the last chapter in the book, you know, when I'm talking about Nas performing with the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center.
I think that was a great way to wrap it up.
I mean, that's, you know, who saw that coming?
Yeah.
You know, Beyonce and Jay-Z in a Tiffany's commercial with a Basquiat painting. Kendrick Lamar winning a Pulitzer Prize. So, you know, the point is hip-hop made all these things because of its massive cultural influence. So I don't necessarily think the subtitle is as hyperbolic as it is attention grabbing.
Yeah.
And I hope that people, when they read the book, you know, if they do read the book, I hope they see, again, this is deluxe. This is more than you thought you were getting.
Yeah.
Because hip hop has had an influence. Hip hop helped elect a president. That's major, right? Barack Obama is on the campaign trail brushing his shoulders off. Like, that's major. You know, Jeezy, my president is black, my Lambo is blue. Like, this is the culture. And so I think the point is history, and it's history over a 50-year period in a way you have probably never seen it represented before.
Yeah. Beautifully said. One of my favorite stories in the book is the story of black people still finding ways to purchase Cadillacs prior to the 1930s, even after General Motors systemically encourage dealerships from selling to them. You know, use the story to explain that when something is denied to someone, it often intensifies their desire to have it. You call this the Cadillac effect. You later use the Cadillac effect to explain rappers celebrating their material possessions, where other people chastise them for flaunting materialism. Why do black people still feel like owning certain luxury items is aspirational when historically, you know, these brands don't feel like our blackness is compatible with their prestige?
Good question. And I'm glad you brought that up, because in all the conversations I've been having, that's something that was really meaningful to me, and nobody's brought it up. You know, the Cadillac effect, which is real. So my father told me a story. My father, born and raised in Detroit, and my father was born in 1926. So, you know, he has since passed away. But my father, you know, grew up in Detroit when most of his friends were people who had migrated to Detroit from down south.
Yeah.
So he had a different point of view. And he told me, like, if you wanted to buy a Cadillac, you would have to give somebody money under the table
mm-hmm.
in order to get it.
So you got to pay a little extra.
You got to pay extra, you know, break somebody off in order to get it. And so I had grown up hearing these stories. And then I learned about, like, Cadillac having this policy, you know, unwritten, I guess, unofficial. But they didn't want their cars sold to black people because it was a prestigious brand. And they thought black people would, you know, bring the brand down. And so the head of service for Cadillac, as he was kind of making his rounds through the various service centers, was surprised to find, you know, he saw black people bringing their cars in for service. And he's like, how could this be? We don't sell, you know, Cadillacs to black people. And he realized, he learned, I guess, that people were paying middlemen. You know, they'd pay a white guy extra to go buy the car for them. And he went back and told General Motors, and he said, you know, basically, black people want these cars so bad, they're willing to pay extra to get them, and we're leaving all this money on the table. Mm-hmm. We could be selling to them directly, right? So when somebody says to you, and this is capitalism,
mm-hmm.
right? You can buy practically anything. Everything's for sale. But no, you can't buy that. Now, it's one thing to say you can't afford it. It's another thing to say you can't buy it. You
can't buy it.
Yeah, you don't, you don't have the money
yeah.
to buy something. That's one thing. You have the money, but I'm not going to sell it to you because I don't want you to have it. Because I think you're going to bring the brand down. And, of course, I talk about what happened later, many years later, with, you know, Jay-Z and Cristal, you know. And basically Cristal saying, you know, we wish they would take their business someplace else. And Jay-Z's response was, thank you would have been sufficient, right?
Yeah.
So I think the point I was trying to make was because of the fact that you denied people the opportunity to purchase something that they could afford, it gave them that much more incentive to prove you wrong. Like, no, you're not going to let me buy it. I'm going to find a way to get it.
Yeah.
Like, that's determination. And so I think for a lot of people, you know, I like clothes. I like brands. I mean, that doesn't bother me. I know a lot of people don't necessarily like these things. So, you know, the way I grew up, like, if somebody was clean, you complimented them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also aspirational, something you aspired to, right? Like, I remember in the 80s, you know, Jay-Z was at the Super Bowl, and he was rocking his S. Dot Carters, which, of course, was a remix of the original Gucci sneakers from the 80s. And I remember those sneakers, and I couldn't afford Gucci sneakers. Yeah. That didn't mean I didn't want them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wanted them. I couldn't buy them. I couldn't afford them. And unlike a lot of other people I knew, I wasn't willing to sell dope to get them.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want them that bad.
Yeah.
But I still wanted them. And so, you know, what's wrong with that? But some people, if you say that, like, you know, oh, you're caught up in brand name. Yeah. What's wrong with that? You know, we're not living in communist China. Like, you know, yeah, I want all that. And let me figure out a way that I can afford it. So to me, it was motivation.
Aspirational.
Yeah, it was. It's like, what do I need to do? As I say, I'm not willing to sell no dope to get it, as a lot of people did. But what do I need to do to put myself in a position to be able to, you know, afford these luxury items that are at this point unattainable?
Mm-hmm.
So I used it as motivation. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of people, a nice brand name, you know, garment, that might be the nicest thing they have.
Yeah.
So why should I deny that pleasure to them? I think it's really, you know, arrogant to say you shouldn't be spending your money on that. You should be, you know, saving for a down payment on a house. Like a pair of shoes and a house, there's a big difference. Exactly. In the price.
It's a very extreme comparison.
But people do it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I'm different. I know a lot of people hate this about me, but, you know.
But what you think?
I'm from Detroit, man. We like to, you know, that's how I grew up. My parents like clothes. I like clothes. I like when people compliment me on my clothes. Like, you know, and, you know, I feel like hip-hop, you know, people start shouting out brands. And I remember when I first started listening to Jay-Z, Reasonable Doubt, and Big, and, you know, I love when those cats were named. Like, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think it's negative. I know a lot of people do, but I take it back to that point of what people were really saying to you when they're dropping all these names is not so much, look at what I have, look at what I had to do to get it.
Yeah.
And it was previously denied me, so I'm celebrating this because this is something you didn't want me to have.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, back to what people you were saying about people comparing or, you know, chastising someone for buying shoes and not saving for a down payment. I mean, a pair of sneakers is like $200. A down payment on a house is thousands.
Yeah, it's like, where can you put $200 down and buy a house? Like, you know? And you're going to wear those sneakers and get some immediate enjoyment out of them. When you buy that house, you buying a job for yourself. So, you know, two different things.
Oh, man. I guess it goes back to the hedonism, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people, I think some people overdo it.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Anything. And some people clearly are doing too much. But one of the great things about hip-hop I appreciate now is dudes rapping about the artwork they have.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was a time when people were telling you how many Jordans they had, and now people are talking about the art they own. So, you know.
50 years.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, you can sell that painting, and, you know, if you get in a cramp, you can sell that painting and maybe get some money for it. Ain't nobody buying them old Jordans. If they do, you're not going to get very much for them.
Yeah, exactly. You can sell that painting, then you could get your down payment.
Yeah. Then you, yeah, exactly. And probably if you own a painting, you probably already got the down payment, yeah. Right? If it's the right artist.
Yeah, definitely. You know, in the book, you were able to give a name to all the different eras of hip hop based on what was happening culturally, socially, and politically. What would you name this era of hip hop in, and what year do you think it started?
You know, I remember this would have been right around the time Obama had gotten elected, and everybody at the time was on Facebook. So did. 2007, 2008, 2009, somewhere in there. I guess 2008 is when Obama got elected. So maybe 08, 09. And at the time, I was listening to Drake and J. Cole and J. Electronica mixtapes.
Yeah.
And, you know, Drake dropped a mixtape. Shit sounded like an album, you know. And I remember I posted this question, like, who's going to be the man? Is it going to be Drake, J. Cole, or J. Electronica? Like, which one of these three? And it's funny because, you know, everybody sat back waiting on J. Electronica, and we finally got that album.
Like 10 years later.
10 years later, exactly. And it was cool, yeah. You know, but to me, that was like waiting on Mayweather and Pacquiao. You waited on it so long that when it finally happened.
It was past their prime.
Yeah, it was like. So a lot of the interest had dissipated in that moment. But, you know, I mean, Drake obviously won that competition. But J. Cole, I mean, I saw that new verse from J. Cole yesterday. I mean, so to me, when I looked at that, it felt like this is a new era. And, you know, I mean, everything that's come after that, had like Future, you know, Young Thug, you know, those cats. Did their thing, and, you know, Lil Baby, I guess, if you want to bring it up to that point, some of these other youngsters. I guess I feel like now I'm not the target audience.
Yeah.
So.
That's a nice way to put it.
You know, like, I don't want to be one of these dudes who, like, you know.
You're not blasting Pound Town?
I can't say that I am, but I'm not hating. You know, I mean, I've been bumping the 21 Savage album. I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
West Side Gun is a cat that I listen to that I've become familiar with in the last, you know, 5-6 years who I really like. And, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I look at it like this. If you watch the NBA, there's a point in your life when you're really young, when you're most impressionable. And the people you see in that time of your life are going to impact you differently than people you see when you're grown. Mm-hmm. So when I started watching the NBA, it was Kareem and Dr. J and Wes Unseld and David Thompson and Gus Williams and, like, you know, all these cats in the 70s. Like, Michael Jordan's a year older than me, so we were in college at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, much respect, but I'm not a kid. Like, to me, we're peers. And then as I get older, like, I can't tell you how many NBA players I've seen their entire career. Like, you know, Kobe Bryant, like, you know, LeBron James, like, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, like, so many players now, I've seen their entire career. If they went to college, I saw that.
Yeah.
And then I saw their entire NBA career. So when I look now, I mean, you know, I see people shooting a lot of threes. I still love the game, but it's not going to hit the way it hit, you know, when I was a kid. It's not going to hit the way it hit, you know, when the Bad Boys were dominating basketball. So I feel like this about hip-hop also. Like, I see these artists, and I don't want to get in debates with people because, as I say, I'm not the target audience, you know. And what these people are doing now, the technology available to them, circumstances, I mean, it's just so different. So I feel like an observer.
Yeah.
I'm not in the mix commenting on it as I would have been previously.
Yeah.
Because it's just, I'm not the audience. Like, you know, you ask me about the greatest MC, I'm gonna tell you about somebody I heard a while back.
Yeah.
It's not gonna be any of these contemporary artists. But if you ask somebody, like I remember a couple years ago, somebody asked Lonzo Ball, and he's like, nobody listens to Nas. I'm like, what you meant to say was you don't listen to Nas.
Yeah, exactly.
You and your peers. The fact that Nas is still putting out albums, I love it.
Yeah.
But I know somebody in their 20s probably not checking for that.
Yeah. And, you know, people get older, and not even just people getting older, but people often fall victim to, like, their own nostalgia. So whatever was popping the most when they were teenagers, when they were falling in love with, you know, whatever media was coming out during their formative years, they think that's the best of that time, you know? So I understand
That's what I'm saying is, whatever point you were impressionable, when you hear people, like, you hear these debates all the time, I'm so tired of them, but who's greater, LeBron or Jordan?
Oh, God, so tired.
It's so tiring. But what are people saying? They're really saying, I like this player better than I like that player. That's what they're really saying. So it's personal preference. And wherever you were, whatever that meant to you personally, that's what you're going to argue. Doesn't necessarily mean that's the best player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then how can you even really determine that, especially if you didn't grow up around the time of, like, one of the players you even – like, I'm 31. I know Michael Jordan when he was on the Wizards.
Okay.
I don't know Jordan in 98. In 98, I was 5.
Right.
So, well, you know.
Much less 88.
Definitely not. My mom was even thinking about me in 88.
Yeah. So, like, you know, I watched, as I say, Jordan's a year older than me. I remember when Jordan was a freshman in North Carolina. I remember when he hit the shot against Georgetown and they won the national title as a freshman. He was Mike Jordan. They called him Mike Jordan. And as he says, after that, he became Michael Jordan, right? I remember being in college and, you know, this was when cable was fairly new. And there was a real popular show called Dynasty that came on Wednesday night. But ESPN had ACC basketball on Wednesday night. And this is when Jordan was at Carolina. Lynn Bias was at Maryland. ACC was stacked. College basketball was stacked.
Yeah, Big East and friends, ACC.
Big East, yeah. I mean, you know, Big Ten, like, and each day, like, Big Monday, they had days for conferences. And my friends and I would walk around campus to try and find a dorm where nobody was watching Dynasty, because those women watching Dynasty had kind of run us out. We had to go find someplace so we could watch Jordan.
Go to a bar
play
or something.
Lynn by it. Well, bars weren't even playing it.
Oh, wow.
It was, like, so specialized that you had to find a dorm, hopefully, that was not, you know, full of people so that you could watch, if you were that interested.
Yeah.
You know, so when I think about all that, it's like I look at these young cats now and I hear them, oh, this person couldn't play in this era. First of all, you're comparing two different things.
Yeah.
And secondly, what they always leave out of these conversations is adaptability.
Yeah.
What makes a great player great is their adaptability. Can you adapt to the circumstances in front of you? And so I'm convinced you take the greatest players, Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain, they would have adapted, you know. So that's why I hate those conversations. But I think, like anything, when people invest themselves in this person was better than that person, what they're really saying is my memory of this person is superior to your memory of that person. And it's less about what they actually accomplished.
Yeah. It's a low-hanging fruit conversation. It's pretty lazy. And I think it's used to drive like clicks and engagement.
Right.
Really
popular.
Yeah. So I had a eureka moment reading the Blaxploitation part of the book, because I finally realized that in all the outrageousness and the cartoonish violence of these films, there's a critique of America, capitalism, labor, and exploitation. They're satirical. These filmmakers did a great job at putting the medicine in the candy, like I said earlier. So what do you think a 2024 Blaxploitation film would look like?
I mean, honestly, I don't think you could make a Blaxploitation film in 2024, because the way I think of Blaxploitation is more as a era than a genre.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about Blaxploitation in the 70s, it was many different genres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were horror films like Blackula. You know, there were family films like Claudine. Then there were, you know, comedy sort of urban films like Dolomite, not to mention the Mac and Superfly and Shaft. Like, all these movies came out at the same period of time, had a similar economic model, et cetera. So I think of Blaxploitation as an era. I don't think of it as a genre.
Yeah.
A singular genre.
You can't recapture it.
No, because the conditions of the era produced those movies. So mm-hmm. You're talking, you know, urban America in the 70s, black mayors being elected in various cities, coming to power, you know, white flight, you know, declining tax base, black power. You needed all those conditions in order to have Blaxploitation, and those things don't exist anymore. So now what you could do is parody it, as several people have done, or imitate it, but I don't think you could recreate it.
Okay. That makes sense.